Summarise the case into a page.
In green as well.
He's turning over a new leaf and all that. But I just am conscious we've got a forest of white paper and wouldn't want to get lost in it. So it does just follow the written submissions. We would have seen we made a handful of points, starting with the benefits of what it is CBP offers all the way through to how the effects can be managed.
I don't know that there's any dispute, is there? I mean, I don't see a competition amongst the range of farmers involved in this matter. I don't think that there's any dispute about the value of vegetables. We may dispute certain types of vegetables, and the Brussels sprouts and rubbish find themselves down the order.
Yes.
I don't know that needs to be pressed on us. I think the bigger issue probably are the issues of scale, and as you have raised the proportionality.
Yes. Well, I won't press it. The reason it's in there at all is that I did detect a sense, at least from some witnesses, that, yes, vegetables are beneficial, but so is everything else. And I wouldn't want the court to take back what I say is simplistic analysis to say, everyone's equal. Because we say, well, actually, over and above the generic good that all primary users offer, which they do, actually vegetables are in a different category because of the nature of the product that's made, and also the fact that I think it's 90% or something is for domestic supply,
yes,
rather than export. So,
and food security
exactly
is a relevant issue,
mm-hmm,
in broader.
Yes, and as I think I just noted, that's something the High Court itself recognised in the recent judicial review about the EPSFN. So, okay, well, I'm happy not to press it, bearing in mind.
Well, as I said, I don't think you need to.
No. And the only other reason I suppose it's in there is one witness who did express some doubt or uncertainty about the benefits was Mr. Counsel, Dr. Counsel for the Director General, and you remember there was one link in the chain of our reasoning that he said, look, I don't agree that there will be an impact on price of vegetables, and so I don't populations will accrue. And so we take issue with that because we say, well, once you understand the full nature, range, and scale and quantum of what's growing in this catchment, then we say, well, actually, you would have to expect that those health detriments will accrue. So we've tried to give you a few references, like the Cleghorn study from Otago, and we've said, no disrespect to the doctor, but I think on his own, free admission, he was no expert in CBP, or I think he even wasn't aware of that Cleghorn study at all. So that's why topic one is in there, really. In terms of topic two, I've thought about it in terms of existing CBP and then expanded CBP. So in terms of existing CBP operating without significant negative water quality effects, the first thing we say is you go to the joint witness statement on water quality, where there's agreement that they expect no net change in at either the subcatchment or FMU level, and of course they acknowledge the potential for localised impacts in certain areas. And all I wanted to emphasise in the submissions was that's quite a carefully worded qualification. It's at that local scale, which is even smaller than the subcatchment scale, and it's for certain areas. So the reason I think that's important is it means that you can manage the potential for effects, no matter how, whether you allow, even if you allow crop rotation at that larger geographical FMU scale. And I'll come back to the ways that it can and will be managed. FEPs, obviously, a key part of it. But that's in terms of existing CVP's effects on water quality. In terms of expanding CVP, I say that also fits under my rubric of operating without significant negative water quality effects. And I say that because the scientific technical data you've got before you from Mr. Easton, who you'll hear from, and Ms. Holmes in support, is that it assumes that entire 1,877 hectares of expansion will be used, and if it is, that's where you get that statistic or outcome of that 0.5% or 80 tonnes. As a whole, that you've heard a bit about, and you'll hear evidence from Mr. Easton and Ms. Holmes about how that's a 0.5% less of an improvement rather than, so it sort of slows the improvement by that 0.5% rather than actually going in the wrong direction overall. But that figure, apart from being very small, is also conservative. And I say that in the sense that on the modelling itself, it gives no credit at all for any grower, CVP or any other sector, putting in place any mitigations. And I say, well, in real life, and you'll hear from growers who are actually doing this, of course they're going to put mitigations in place. It's those pieces of evidence that we bring together to say, in conclusion, for that second point, that actually it can operate in a way that doesn't have significant effects on the environment. The third section.
I suppose this can be
yes.
Sorry to interrupt.
Please, no.
It doesn't meet the aspiration that it does of restoration which requires betterment.
Well,
it's maintaining, is what you're effectively saying.
Well, I think because of the conservatism of that assumption, it might even be doing better than maintaining. Because like I say, that's a pretty major assumption that no one's going to do anything at all.
That's taking the worst case scenario, right?
Yeah.
So, which is what we do.
Sure.
Legally trained people, we take the worst case scenario.
Yes.
So, taking that worst case scenario, I suppose, and I understand what you're saying about the numbers being relatively low. However, if the aspiration of to do the fund runner is restoration from the five betterment at that worst case scenario, it's not present.
And I suppose all I can say is I think there's room to legitimately not just focus on the worst case scenario. Given that those mitigations will be put in place, and it's not just on the faith of prudent growers who want to do the right thing. It's going to be in the FEPs, and you're going to have to say what exactly you're going to do and then do it. So that's why I say it might be unduly pessimistic to say, well, technically, on a very worst case scenario with no mitigations, it's not going in the right direction. I think that it's an appropriate course for the court to take to say, well, actually the most realistic scenario is this, and what are the effects in that scenario? And I say that they won't be necessarily limited to just maintaining the level of degradation today. And partly that's where that third section of our submissions comes in to play, where I try to explain why I can stand up here and say, well, CVP can operate without their significant effects, and there's a few reasons. So the first one is actually inherent in crop rotation itself. That's a process that is fundamental to CVP operating, but it's also inherent in that process to maintain soil nutrients. You heard that it can reduce soil erosion if there's planting in that fallow phase, and it prevents disease, and it's done for pest control. So I guess my point is it's not a process that just benefits the grower and their bottom line and, juicier fruit and more lush vegetables. It's actually a process that is in sync with the environmental improvement as well. So I say that's part of the explanation of why the effects will not be significant. The other aspect of it is that there are a range of industry measures and they're effective. You will hear evidence of between 70 and 100% participation by growers in those measures. The big one that you've heard me try and get across through questioning of other witnesses is the GAP, Good Agricultural Practices. It's voluntary, but also it's a prerequisite to market access. So it's, I would call it voluntary plus. And there's an environmental standards add-on, and that's the one that I think you'll hear that 70% of people are already doing. And it's pretty sophisticated. It's got guidance on erosion and sediment control, nutrient management, all things which obviously we're interested in as mechanisms by which to improve river health in this nature.
It does seem to us that it's a very positive thing that farmers responding to the requests or requirements of their groupings or their perhaps primary customers, who are in turn responding to the demands of markets for a demonstration of responsibility, sustainability, and so on. It does seem to us that to the extent that those commercial or market or organisational requirements or suggestions converge with the regulatory aspects under the Resource Management Act or other legislation, that's something which we in our decision making role should definitely take into account and say, well, surely this is where we can build on these things, so that rather than perhaps farmers saying we have additional and conflicting requirements, they say we have an overarching requirement, and if we have a plan, hopefully it's a plan that meets the GAP, meets the NFE requirements, meets the regional council's requirements. Is that what we're aiming for?
I think it's a laudable aim, and I think it needs to be done in a way that avoids two things: one, reinventing the wheel, and two, So you have to do, you know, two or three versions of pretty much the same thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And the gap and the yesterday in the evidence before us, examples of them?
Yes, I think there are, and certainly there's witnesses who can, in their written briefs, speak to them from the court side more than the PBGA people. Yeah, so you'll definitely hear about that.
I did try and find those in the evidence and I couldn't find them.
All right.
I think we'd be really helped.
Okay.
Because in my desperation over the weekend, I went to the website and looked at the EMS.
Yes.
And I thought that was very helpful.
Okay.
But we actually need that to help us help you to make it the process as efficient as possible.
Yes, so got it.
If we can have those things and if you could lead your witnesses on those
yes.
those kind of things and provide us with them, that would be very helpful.
Yes, I'll make sure that the best witness to speak to them can perhaps produce a copy through that means. And so the other sort of strand of that third point is the FEPs specifically. I said that I'd get to those, and I think I've laboured the point potentially through cross-examination that there's a few notable features of FEPs for commercial vegetable growers. One is that they're mandatory for all CVP, large or small, new or old, that's different to some other uses, and it's always that more stringent D2 type. And I say it's more stringent because it's independently reviewed, certified, and of course it has to be updated. So we're in a situation with the proposed TC1 where if it goes through, all CVPs are going to come under the close scrutiny of those FEPs. And you also heard evidence already from the council that they take it seriously. It's a living document, and they'll not hesitate to enforce it. And I think it's one of the council witnesses explained that, you know, if they weren't happy with the form that you put in or the proposals you've got on it, they will question you on it until they're satisfied. So it's a real measure. And for CVP, it's another strand that I say means that those the environmental effects that can improve will be appropriately dealt with. Then I turn to point four, which is why it's essential to ensure that CVP is actually workable under PC1. And I suppose if I can summarise that perhaps lengthy section of my submissions, it's an appeal to fairness or equity. And I say that because others have of course done the same, but they've done it under the, I don't want to say guise, because I'm not trying to be pejorative at all, but using the superficially attractive principle of all equally doing our part, rolling up our sleeves and contributing. Now, I really don't want CVP to be misunderstood to be saying, you know, leave us alone entirely, we don't need to do anything. That clearly isn't the position that CVP takes, or in reality, how they treat the activity that they do. Like I say, there's a wide range of measures they already take. But what I take issue with is that kind of call to equality as being the appropriate principle. And I said it's superficially attractive, and of course it is, because it does sound good in theory, but what I say it presupposes, or the premise of it, is that we're all equally contributing contaminants in the first place. And I say, well, where that's not the case, and not the case by a mile, then I think I'd urge the court to adopt a different principle, which is the principle of proportionality. And I say it's not by a mile, and I suppose the support for that is the fact that, again, as maybe we've labelled, but maybe it was necessary, that CVP is just, you know, a small, not even a percent of the total area, 2.5% of the nitrogen, less than a percent of the phosphorus. So we really are in a different category to some of the other interests sitting behind me. And so it's not, like I say, it's really not a call for complete inaction but it's a call for almost reciprocity, or the quid pro quo for putting the restrictions on CVP, which are more restrictive than some of the other land uses behind me. The quid pro quo of that is that I say, well, at the very least, I think we need to work hard to make sure that the provisions that we're imposing enable CVP to operate workably. So, and I heard Your Honour right off the bat use the word proportionality, so perhaps I don't need to say much more about that. But you would have seen in the submissions that we identify that as a legal point and an important one. And that we say, look, that's actually the legal yardstick here. And I've given some case law about that, which I can discuss a bit more if you like, or I can.
I think that most of that's quite well known. I don't think there's any issue about a sense of proportion permeating Section 32 of the Act, which is what you have said at sections, paragraphs 31 and 32 of your submissions. You referred to King Salmon, judgment of scale or proportion, and reasonable practicability, and of course, for discharges under the RMA, a definition of best practicable option, which incorporates that kind of assessment. I mean, the marginal note that I've made about this is that there has to be a contextual assessment, and that includes factually the context, so that the way in which CVP operates is a different way than the way in which farming animals operates. Generally speaking, at least at this stage, your client's crops don't wander about. We have to look at that in its context. I think part of that proportionality is an overall sense of fairness, and so not clobbering somebody who's at the smaller end of the scale. But I think you're right to indicate at the outset in relation to this, your clients can't make a just leave us alone submission in relation to this. And so the question is, what is reasonable in the overall context of the plan change? Should there be a significant change in agricultural production in the PC1 catchments? Who knows? These things might change. And there still has to be something which says, well, if there were to be any substantial change, what effect would that have on the water quality of the river?
That's right, and you need to know that, or at least have scientific evidence about it, in an actual factual situation.
Could I just comment on as well, because you referred to an Environment Court decision which I wrote.
Yes, is this the minute?
Did you read that, the whole of the decision?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Okay, because one of the things we said there was that we accept the consent conditions, and the reason for accepting them was on the grounds of proportionality, because it was nitrogen, phosphorus, E. coli, and sediment, and we looked at are they doing their proportionally contributing to the overall catchment production, and that's how we looked at proportionality in that context, and I imagine that's about as fair as you can get, that everyone does a fair amount towards contributing to the whole issue. I read your submissions in saying in part that we're only small, so we can get away with doing less than everybody else. That may well be wrong, but that's a sort of inference that I got a little bit.
Well, I think I am saying that we are saying that we can do less than the people who are contributing a huge amount of the contaminants in the first place, because to require CVP to do so, if there's three main uses, a third each or whatever, hypothetically, then that isn't proportional. So I think we're this idea of getting away with doing less clashes with clobbering the small guy, then I think not clobbering the small guy does have to win out.
I don't think you get past any higher court if you try that. You can do a third of it.
So I of course wouldn't use the language of getting away with, because you're here for growers who take seriously and do know of their impact. But if we we phrased it in a... I think the point you're making is one that I'm making. I think you read it right, that we are saying, look, we are doing our part, but when you're only contributing a couple of percent of the contaminants in the first place, doing your part means less than what the people who are contributing 30, 40, whatever, 50% of the contaminants need to do.
Well, the nature of proportionality isn't equality, but it is still a sense of equivalence. There's still,
yeah.
I mean, on a proportionate basis,
yes.
A person does their share. The
yes.
Share is not an equal share, the share is a proportionate share.
Yes. Happy with that? Yeah.
And that's the way the court interprets it exactly in that decision.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. No issue at all if that's the way the court's approaching its task when it comes to CVP, for sure. Then I guess we're starting to get to the pointy end in sections 5
yeah.
through to 7. 5 is what are the problems with PC1 for CVP? And the main things I've tried to identify in the submissions is first this attempt to define a baseline amount of CVP with that complicated two-part definition. You'll remember I explored that with Mr. Trevilco, and I think in his defence he was saying, look, I inherited this, it's kind of grown tentacles over the years, and it's the best way that he could think of coming up with a baseline. Now, I get the need for some way of defining this is what we mean by existing CVP, but I just submit really that the way it's done is not sensible. It will artificially limit the amount of baseline CVP, even though it's done in the name of actually maintaining the status quo. It won't do that. And I think you would have seen my stylized example in the written submissions. And it was the same sort of one I used in questioning, the idea of 100 hectares, where that if you break it down to that subcatchment level, you might be actually artificially saying, right, the year where you had 10 in that subcatchment and 90 in another, that's your biggest year. So that's the year we're all saying is your existing baseline. But forevermore, in that subcatchment, your existing, so-called existing maximum, is 10 for that one subcatchment, just because you happen to have to plot that bit here.
I mean, I thought quite a bit about, this is paragraph 39 of your main submission,
yes.
And that example, and I just wanted to ask you, what are the areas which that operator has in each of the subcatchments, or alternatively, what's the total? It seemed to me that you could say that the area being operated in was 100 hectares. Alternatively, you might say it could be 170 hectares or something else by adding 80 in year 3 for subcatchment 1 and 90 in year 1 for subcatchment 2.
Mm.
So I just wonder, I mean, what is your... On the assumption that a CVP operator will, going forward, know I have this land resource that is available to me. And there's several things that go into that. Primarily, we've got how much are they going to crop in any year and how much will they leave fallow. I understand that those balances can change, and that's what your example says.
Yes.
But in overall terms, for the foreseeable future, what is the area that this operator is saying, this is my land resource?
Well, I think it would be the total land area of their operation.
Yeah. Including any fallow areas from year to year.
Yeah.
Right. So, and I'm not sure in relation to this, does that mean that's 170 hectares on this example?
No, well, I think it's 100.
100?
100, because in that year they're saying, right, I think in each of the years the operation is 100, but it might be across different subcatchments and there might be different geographical
spots. Well, that's then the second issue of whether it's subcatchment or
yes.
FMU basis.
Yes.
Because it seemed to me that the main issue, therefore, would be that there'd be a farm environment plan for this operator, which would indicate that their maximum cropped area in any year for the life of that farm environment plan would be 100 hectares. everything set out in narrative form, I would expect that year on year they'll adjust that depending on what they choose to grow, unless they're one of those who's just always wheat or always potatoes or whatever it might be. What their general rotational policy is, like what would they ordinarily look at leaving fallow? But primarily, I would have thought, for the purposes of PC1, the main issue is to what extent then, I mean, possibly the nature of the crop, but to what extent then are they importing anything, nutrients, in order to keep that operation going? And how is that assessed in terms of their mitigation efforts to control losses from that? Is that what you would envisage as their council they'd be doing?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, and when I get to the final section, we've suggested some improvements, and I think the final one is you've hit on the head of, which is I think PC1 is already trying to do this, but it should be more express about it. Because I've seen it uses that language of DPP is to identify your anticipated parcels of land and the crop rotation and what you're going to do, and as I understand it, from the evidence that you'll hear, by and large, crop rotation is well planned and well in advance. So it has to be, partly because of the science behind it, partly because of the, you know, urban greed and lack of resources, so you have to lease a lot. And so I think I can see how it would be consonant with the reality of what growers are doing to have the FEP say, this is my operation. Here's where it goes, here's how it works in general terms.
And then from the council's point of view, in terms of the modelling that it's undertaking, you can say, for your operation, we know that you're operating within 100 hectares, and that you've got the following plan for how you're likely to do that, and appreciating changes may occur over the life of the plan.
And that works too, because remember there's that requirement for EPPs to be updated, and you have to keep the council the rest of it. And so, if something did change, then you'd update your EPP and it would have to be certified and accepted and so on. So, I submit it can be workably done. Finishing up on point five before we get to the exciting world of solutions, Your Honour did touch on the problem being exacerbated. Well, this is how I would put it. By setting the baseline at that subcatchment level rather than the FMU level. And there's a few problems with that. The maybe most important one is that just doesn't reflect reality. The growers are giving evidence saying, we don't rotate at the limit of the subcatchment. You've got growers, a lot of them are larger, because that's how the history was developed. A single operation spans multiple subcatchments. Whereas they're saying, well, look, at least at the FMU level, we could make that work. And the other problem with the subcatchment being the reference point is this potential, at least, for adverse environmental effects, where if you're saying, well, you're only a controlled activity if you're sticking within subcatchment 28 or whatever, you might artificially incentivise or unintentionally incentivise people to not have to go down the discretionary path. Just sticking, or doing more and more in the next subcatchment. And that may be the thing that actually leads to concentration of CVP, which could actually be a problem environmentally speaking. Whereas if you let it happen at the FMU scale, you're spreading CVP over a larger geographical area, so you're reducing the likelihood of that unintended environmental consequence.
And I don't, I'm not seeking to present an argument on your behalf, but it's possibly also something where the overall scale of CVP activity means that the need to try to assess activities at the subcatchment level is not as significant as it might be, say, for dairy farming. Because the fact that a farmer happens to have some fields over the hill and therefore in a different subcatchment, which is part of the rotational operation, may not matter a great deal when we get to either a lake or from a merino or the river.
yeah, a couple of thoughts on that. One on home reno specifically. That modelling by Mr. Easton about 1 acre and 7 hectares is specifically excluded going into the home reno at all. But the second point is a more general one, and it's that the water quality science is saying the effects are a potential for localised effects in certain areas. So that supports the thesis that Stevie Peters is a bit different in terms of what are we actually, what are the environmental, what scale of effects is the appropriate one to be monitoring here? And I think once that's accepted, then the dichotomy of subcatchments or FMUs disappears, and actually allowing FMUs is a good solution, because on the one hand it makes crop rotation actually work how it works, but on the other hand, whether it's an FMU isn't the thing that's going to determine the environmental effects, because they're going to have to be identified, mitigated at that local,
at the local
level.
And the proposal on behalf of Fish and Game that the Whangarino wetland be a separate FMU, that wouldn't alter your reasoning, would it?
No. No, it would potentially just be a good thing, because it would deal with Fish and Game's environmental concerns for that particular environment, but would fit quite well with CVP being enabled in the rules at the FMU level. So I had a brief section 6 on the way I thought of it in my mind was, well, what aren't the solutions and what are the solutions? And that might be too crude, but it kind of worked for me. In terms of a list of things that won't work, I've tried to clump together some things that, to the pretty limited extent that other parties have weighed in on CVP in this case. Every now and then I did hear an idea and so I thought, well, I better address it and think about whether it's a sensible one. The first one was this idea of minimum standards. The proponent of that was Mr. Willis, but as I think Fish and Game put it this morning, well, I think he moved away from that himself. And I think there's three things that make my clients doubt this as a solution to hold up. The first is pretty simple one, it's that none exist. And as you heard today, understanding is that there isn't really a consensus about what those minimum standards would be. The next problem is what I've called regulatory overlay. And in some of the questioning, I think particularly of Dr. Crystal or Ms. Foster, Ms. Ford, for Horton, and took her through and showed that there are similarities between some of the things you cover in minimum standards and some of the things that are covered in those existing industry measures, which I hear you saying, you'd like to actually see them, and that makes sense. And then the other slightly more philosophical objection to minimum standards is that I think they're premised on this false equality, where you heard people like Mr. Willis explaining, well, everyone else has them and so should you, and we submit that unfortunately misunderstands that actually there are differences between CVP and these other uses, among them other. But as I say, all CVP in every single case has to have resource consent, and it has to have those more stringent D2 EPPs, and you can't say the same for other land uses where minimum standards exist. So equality is good as long as it's like for like that you're comparing, and in the case of CVP versus others, it's not like. Then there was a brief suggestion that there should be a separate consenting path for high impact CVP, and I don't say much at all about that because, again, there was, I think, Justin Mr. Willis who proposed that, and I think it's fair to say it was a faint proposal at that, which then yielded to his preference for minimum standards, and on some light questioning, he kind of shied away from going with the high impact proposal, and so then he's left with minimum standards, which I've already discussed. And then on the other side of the tables, there's the blanket 10 metre setback proposal for CVP cultivation, primarily, I think, proposed by the Director General. Fish and Game and support, but I think, again, as you heard just this morning, no evidence on it. For CBSP, especially from Ms. Maher, I think, was the one who said that. And the objections by the horticultural sector to this rule is one, the mandatory nature of it. And the reason that's a problem is that it doesn't allow, well, it means the imposition of a measure which may be less effective or actually not effective on a particular farm. And so we say, well, actually there's a better way of doing it, which is manage these effects at the local scale. There are measures which will tend to work better for seed cultivation, and there's a scientific reason for setbacks not working in every case, and it's this concept of channelised flow, and you'll hear evidence from Mr. Barber about that for horticulture interests. And CBP does have that channelised flow, at least it tends to. And so I think even the Director General's expert on these setbacks, though professing not to really know about CBP, did accept that the setbacks are less effective where channelised flow is in play. And so if that's the case, we're saying, well, don't make them mandatory. They might be useful in some cases, and in which case you find them in the EPP. But there are other alternatives, from bundling to sediment traps. And again, you can ask the Port and PVGA witnesses about that. And the final thing I put in the category of solutions that won't work is overseer of the CBP, and that might be enough said on that topic. There's been no witness at all who, I guess we haven't heard from the iwi interest, but I'd be pretty surprised if they were any different, but there's been no witness who has promoted the use of overseer for CBP. There's been either a lack of knowledge or an acceptance by witnesses that there is a range of CBP-specific problems with using overseer.
Well, I mean, presumably the crop type governs fixation, so...
Yep, so crops is a good example of a problem because it doesn't even have all the crops that vegetable growers use, so you have to use proxies. The monthly data is the most fine-grained scale, as I understand it, and that's far too crude for CBP, where vegetables grow and things change much more rapidly than the month scale. And in our submissions, you will have seen just a few, perhaps, key references telling the overseer story from beginning to end from the Section 32 report, where concerns were identified to Fish and Game's Exhibit 2, produced a couple of weeks ago, which still concludes that you need caution when you're using overseer for regulatory purposes for CBP. And so I've been taken to task, I think, by my learned friend for Fish and Game, I think, for having the throwaway line in our submissions that we don't see a need for a separate 293 process. We agree with the indications that have been made throughout the hearing that this might be one of those situations where everyone's very well represented. The issues are fully ventilated, and so there's no need to kick it for touch for scope issues. And I think my learned friend accepted that, seems to say you can only use, there's only scope to use overseer, I think, at the gateway, can't have alternatives put alongside it at that level. And then once you get through the gateway, then you can have alternatives. And I say with respect that that's really a question, a matter of semantics. And it kind of demonstrates my learned friend's acceptance that she needs to explain you can have alternatives at some point in the planning framework or analysis. To me, it concedes that there is a big problem with using overseer. And so then the question of whether it's at the gateway or some other stage, I say really, it's just getting down to anything else, I don't think about overseer and CBT, seeing as no one's promoting it. And so we're quite happy with Mr. Fibulco's removal of it. Then we get to the crescendo of what the solution is, possibly the most important section of our submission, and we've set out a range of ways to improve Land Change 1 from the grower's perspective in light of everything I've said in the first six sections. And I'll try to summarise them in a few bullet points. In terms of policy 3, you would have seen that we're keen for CVP to be provided for and managed, and for that special contribution to be reinstated, and I think I've covered the reasons why in section 1. In terms of policy 5, I can be pretty brief on that too, because what it seems to me should happen is that the underlying idea that overall river health is what improvement is where we're heading, I think that it's got to be a good one. But I think that means that there's room for a policy 5 type mechanism where the exact route or means by which you get to that overall trend of improvement can be, in part, dealt with by offsetting in some cases or compensation in others. So there's been a lot of talk of nutrient trading, which arguably is an emotive term which just clouds the issue of is the logic of policy 5 sound, and I say yes it is. The next solution, which I think we've already covered, is the definition of the existing baseline of CVP can be simplified. You heard Mr. Tribulco in questioning more or less explain that he didn't have a particularly compelling reason why he needed that two-part definition. I think he at one point said, oh, well, I inherited it, or, you know, I didn't write it, I just happened to spend it. Not his words, that's my summary. But and then I say that doesn't justify imposing or baking in this poor attempt at a definition just in the name of, oh, well, it's how we bung it in there in the first place. And we talked about how we can make it simpler, you know, Your Honour, already. Then the next solution is replacing that subcatchment scale in terms of crop rotation or CVP being able to operate with VFMU level. Paragraph 68 of my submission covers this in some detail, and that's the one time in this presentation that I would like to go there rather than just summarise it, because it sets out the wide range of reasons why pitching it at the FMU level is appropriate. So at 68, you see A through to G set out a number of reasons, and the first one there at A is that the FMU scale is the one that's more consistent with what actually happens in real life, and you'll hear evidence that is so. The second thing is a follow-on, really, because enabling crop rotation, as we say there at B, at the FMU scale, is important to provide enough CVP growing area to protect and maintain those features there, soil health, but also those important aims of food security and keeping up with population growth. The third one is, I think I've already summarised it in our discussion earlier, but it's the idea that actually calling it or pitching it at the FMU scale, that's not going to be the thing that determines whether the environmental impact will be negative or neutral or positive. And I've plucked out from a couple of pieces of evidence, admittedly by analogy, to people adverting to the advent of the FMU for one thing or another. And it is by analogy because they weren't talking about CVP, but to me it was interesting and telling that seems to be some implicit acceptance that, of that point, that letting something happen at anything new scale is not in and of itself going to lead to negative environmental impacts.
I think that the other thing that links to it is your acceptance in response to me that the FEP would in fact identify what the area of the operation is actually going to be. So the risk of somebody then saying, I will now take my consent and charge across the region and do something in an area that nobody was aware I was going to do something in, that also would be prevented because you have to comply with the FEP.
Mm-hmm. You do. You do.
Doesn't have to be at the whole FMU level. Could it be that,
that's what I'm really saying, is that the FEP would actually identify the area that's involved.
I just think that
going the rules preclude them from being able to go outside a subcatchment in terms of the definition. Is there concern?
Oh yeah, certainly if the rules didn't preclude it, or if it was made express that they didn't, that would help. Whereas I see what you're saying is, can we actually do away with this classification of subcatchment versus FMU altogether? Is that?
I was just thinking of the emotive nature of going from a small area to a big area, that's all I was thinking.
Yes.
That's not really what's proposed. What's really proposed is, instead of being constrained to a subcatchment boundary, the FEP would indicate we're going to operate on this land, which is in the following subcatchment.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I can see that would be...
Right, well, the 100 hectares would be identified.
Yeah.
And then the fact that it was in different subcatchments wouldn't be a big deal. If it was a big deal because a particular subcatchment had any particular aspect to it, such as a wetland area or a lake, then again, the FEP would address that. You'd expect it.
Yes. I suppose the only counterpoint is to try and be broadly consistent with the, some of the higher order documents like the NPSFM, which does talk at the scale of FMUs, or parts of them, no mention of subcatchments that I'm going to check that. But it's that direction is at that FMU level. And the council itself, you know, in terms of the expansion book, speaks in at that FMU level. So I think it was perhaps our attempt to weave it all together in a cohesive way to say, well, it seems like the choice in this plan change is either subcatchments or FMUs, and so I think if that is the dichotomy and it's a true one, then FMUs are the winner. But if the court's saying, well, we think we can do it in a better third way, then I take no issue with that.
That's your point, D&D.
Yes, that's right.
So the suggestion seems to be that allows flexibility in your ability, your CVP farmer's ability to rotate crops, and some of that rotation is going to occur on leased land. Does the leased land have to be, the decision to lease a piece of land might be relatively short term?
I think asking the growers about some of that would be quite useful, because my understanding is that a lot of the leases are long-term leases, or more on the longer term, and it's usually planned in advance, because you might be rotating 3-6 crops, you know. And so I don't know if that is right, that many are short-term. But it does get to one of the solutions. In terms of, I think I've described them more, I think in my mind at least, as tidy ups, and once I get to the lease one, I may as well get to it now. One thing we've suggested, a question to Trebuka about it, was to get around this lease problem for growers, which is you might rotate on to the next piece of land, but the consent runs with the land, and so the landowner might rub their hands with glee and say, well, I'll hold on to that, and then suddenly you're not 100 hectares anymore. You've got your 100 plus whatever the landowner is holding on to. And so I asked, well, what if you could relinquish the consent and reapply made the NPP even to say, well, the 100 hectares is now in this geographical area. Would that work? And again, to be fair to Mr. Shibbolcroft, recall he hadn't particularly turned his mind to that, but didn't think the rules prohibited it. And so one of the solutions I'm asking the court to draft in is to make it express that this relinquishment and reapplication without jeopardising the consent states would be very useful.
Yes.
There's one solution I skipped over, which is how to deal with overseer, but I think we'll move on. So in terms of the other tidy ups, one was that relinquishing and reapplying all under the controlled consent. Another one was, this really is just a potentially minor one, which is that the consent should refer to CVP in general rather than specific crops. Mr. Trebilco thought that is what the consent would say, and CVP is a defined term, so I submit it would work without unintended consequences, but it would just be useful for the grower to know what the consent permits.
I've got to say, I sometimes get overexcited by definitions, but to have means the commercial growing of vegetables in New Zealand, which I would have thought was
pretty obvious,
something that we take for granted, intended for human consumption, so as opposed to, say, crops for the stock feed, etc., and then including in the following list, in the very long list. Now, I confess, I have not been through that list to see it include broccoli and Brussels sprouts.
I'm sorry about
that. I have not been through it to see whether all of my favourites are. I see that there are some things like Indian vegetables, which are just referred to very generally, and I'm fascinated to know what that is. And I just, again, I wonder if a great deal of space is taken up. Is that something which your clients are concerned about, that their particular crops are there, given that it says included?
No, exactly. No. And I confess, I know there is a huge amount of food-related legislation and secondary legislation. I don't know if that's where that list has come from or not, but there might be a special reason for it that I'm unaware of.
Except that it's inclusive, so if there's anything there that you can think of that isn't in that list, it wouldn't be excluded anyway.
Indeed. And then the final tidy-up is, again, I think we've already dealt in the discussion we've had about updating the EPP and putting in your anticipated CVP operation in the first place, but it's making clear that doing that, so saying what your operation is, where it's going to go, how it works, what your rotation intentions and policy are, it would be good to make it express in the plan change that you don't have to go and apply for a new controlled resource consent every time you rotate. As long as it's in that, it's identified, it's defined, you're saying what you're doing, you're identifying the land over which you're doing it. Having read the provisions, it appears that's implicit. And not cutting across some intention in the rules that I'm missing. But again, I think we've heard from a range of witnesses saying this thing needs to be a standalone document understandable by people in the future who haven't had the benefit of listening to this call pass for 6 weeks. They're just going to pick it up and go, well, hang on, do I need to get a new consent every single time or not?
That surely is something which the Farm Environment Plan is an ideal way of saying, well, you set out what it is you say you are going to do.
Yes.
And it would only be if you depart from that in a material way, you might have to come back and say to the council, I need this. An interesting question is whether or not amendments to the Farm Environment Plan require a full-scale application for alteration of the consent, or whether they could be dealt with in another way. But I don't
being sought there and why, and the written submissions I've tried to take accord to the pieces of the plan where that I'm trying to glean this intention from, just to be sure that we're not seeking something that's going to cut across the key to the whole thing, and I submit it doesn't do that. So, happily, that leads me to the witnesses. I told all my learned friends the order last week that we're going to call them in. Would you like me to run through that so you can note
it
down?
Is there any order you've got in paragraph 73 of the plan?
Let me see.
I mean, you're entitled to call who you like in whatever order you like, but it will help us.
So yes, the horticultural witnesses, horticulture NZ witnesses are as per that paragraph. I don't think we said in order for the PBGA witnesses.
No.
We're through me facilitating them,
yes,
joining in by giving evidence. So that's the role that I'll be taking for them. And we were proposing Dr. Stuart Davis, followed by Carrick Makan, M-A-K-A-N,
yes.
Kelly Deal, D-E-I-H-L, and then Miss Faulkner's happily been excused, thank you again. And then Mr. Bharat Javan, J-I-V-A-N, Brendan Ball, and then Brent Wilcox to finish. There might be availability reasons that mean we can't get them over from in time, in which case we'll switch it around, but we've got to do my best to make it as orderly as possible. So there's still 20 minutes before lunch. I'm quite happy to call Mr. Sands and get on with it.
I think you should.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Digital, are you involved in the Horizons Climate Change 2 case?
No. I'm aware of it. And Hort is involved, and it's got the same instructions as solicitors, but I'm unavailable, so I'm not.
Okay, well, one of the things I'm interested in is that I understand some of the evidence is saying that it's possible to reduce nitrogen from the activities by 35% and possibly up as much as 70%. I would like your witnesses to address that, because I think Mr. Barber has been involved in his evidence. If that's the case, if you could take an awful lot of the heat out of these things, if it's possible to reduce by those kind of levels, because that's even the lower figure is the sort of figure that we're looking for proportion to organic by level. So
yes.
I would like
our witnesses to address practical mechanisms or means by which reductions can be achieved.
And
yes,
whether any have been done in that case, it was because there has been no significant reductions since the plan change was, since the original plan was introduced.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can actually make some fairly significant reductions relatively easily.
Yes.
I'd like to know whether the same situation applies here.
Certainly, and I'm very keen for the witnesses to be questioned on that, because I'm aware that without giving evidence as a lawyer, that there are existing technological ways by which to reduce that N load.
I have seen that in your evidence to this case, and so that's why I raised it.
Yes, thank you.
Now, in terms of your concern about sediment control, and I do understand exactly where you're coming from in terms of a 10-metre strip may not actually achieve a lot if all the flow goes to a 1-metre length or 100-metre. Is something along the lines of, in terms of the effectiveness of sediment control, has to be demonstrated by the BPO? Is that something that might... I can put it to a witness.
Yeah, I think that would be preferable, yeah.
I'm only putting these things out there so that your witnesses can start to think about it.
Yes, and they're duly noted.
We want to stop the sediment going into the environment, basically.
Yes.
And if the court was to put a requirement for 10 metres, didn't actually achieve money, that would be a very sensible thing to do. So I'd like to explore that with your witnesses.
Thank you.
And the other problem more yet, efficiency of process, and
yes,
you obviously have certifiers and auditors for the NZJAP and EMS process.
your view that it would be possible to use the same auditors, certifiers and auditors for the regulatory process that the regional council would need to go through?
Yes, I submit. I can see the merit in that. From memory, they have to be qualified in a way and the regulations cover that. So as long as they were duly qualified as auditors or certifiers under what the law requires, I can see that work.
Is that something you prefer rather than have separate certifiers and auditors for the different processes?
I think you'd have to ask.
Sorry?
I think you'd have to ask our. Witnesses about that. I don't have a submission about that at this time.
And you've suggested a simpler baseline description for CPP. Is it covered anywhere in your evidence what your preferred or what New Zealand's preferred wording would be? Is that anywhere at the moment?
I think it would be in Ms. Ruston in our plan as evidence or joint witness statement. I just haven't reread that for some time, so I just want to check before I give you advice that ends up being wrong.
Perhaps you come back through your witness and take another time. And just one last point.
Yes.
It comes back to the equity issue you raised.
Are
you still concerned about the discretionary activity status or restricted discretionary? Were you looking for anything there?
No, the report, as you know, initially suggested restricted discretionary could be appropriate for expansion, but in this appeal, it's accepted that it's going to be a discretionary one, and so the question just becomes how to word it in a way that is workable.
Thank you.
And I think that touches on His Honour's point earlier about actually is that is the key to the CPP rather than the status that we call it.
Yes, and as I say, a reasonable approach on the part of the consent authority to what it does look into, even for a fully discretionary activity, when the focus for applications in relation to these rules, should be it's a major issue, but it's a relatively confined issue, so landscape assessments are probably not required.
If you felt able to say something in the judgment, that would be very useful.
Except to the extent that the landscape may involve fruit and source areas, I suppose.
All right. Well, I call Michelle Sands.
Thank you very much.
Can you please confirm your full name for the court?
Michelle Kathleen Sands.
And have you prepared a brief of evidence, a statement of evidence, in this appeal dated 28th July this year?
Yes.
And stand up, doesn't it? Do you confirm that evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and ability?
Yes.
And I saw that in your evidence you're actually a qualified water scientist, and were you the author of the so-called SANS report?
Yes, I was, and that's explained in paragraph 15.
Yes, and Are you aware that during the course of questioning, it emerged that there may be, there was a discussion about the E. coli pie charts, which were converted into diagrams. You know about that?
Yes.
And did you have any clarification to make about the SANS report in line with that discussion?
Yes, I can explain.
Yeah.
So the pie charts that are presented in that report, which was provided as an appendix to Hawkins Head's submission, they were based on modelling undertaken by NIWA for Plan Change On, and there are pie charts that show sediment nitrogen and E. coli phosphorus. Stuart Easton has just checked those pie charts on the basis of the evidence that Dr. Crystal presented, because it's a thing from, and we have found that there's an error in those pie charts in the submission, so that there is no error with the nitrogen or the phosphorus or sediment, those are correct, but the E. coli ones are not correct. And so where it says in the pie chart that the load of E. coli from CBC is 2.5%, it should say 0.1%, so much lower. And that is why when Dr. Crystal did the back calculation, she sort of came up with an unlikely result, which kind of indicated that perhaps E. coli was higher than from CBP than sort of expected. That's not the case. And if you go back to the base data, that those pie charts were built on, which was undertaken by Dr. Samadini Davis from NIWA, the actual yields are provided, and that information you can see that the yield on a per hectare basis, the CBP is much lower, 1/16 of dairy farming, 1/3 of sheep and beef farming. And I can also confirm that the evidence presented by Stu Easton and Gillian Holmes, they used the, you know, they didn't use the pie chart, they used the base models that were provided by NIWA to Jacobs, and they have, as explained in GM Holmes' evidence, they have been checked by NIWA. So, you can have confidence in the results of the modelling and the evidence, and that concludes that that's used both for the assessment of rotation, comparing the FMU and the subcatchment scale, and like the English rule, but it's also used for the assessment of land use change, and that assessment at the farm scale, which suggests that CBP, which relates to beef farming or dairy farming, that there may be an increase in nitrogen but a decrease in E. coli. And just to clarify, that is at the farm scale, but overall at the river scale, you would still expect an improvement in both E. coli and nitrogen.
And when you refer to the underlying data being correct, is that model or actual or something else entirely?
Yeah,
I'm trying to understand the nature of the data that you're talking about.
It's modelled. So NIWA, or Dr. Samadini Davis, and NIWA created a range of water quality models for Plan Change 1 for Wakaka Regional Council, and they had yields for E. coli for each land use activity, and they had nitrogen leaching assumptions for each land use activity, and sediment losses, which were based on land but not so much activity. Those numbers were all models, estimates, but they were put together into these catchment scale models that were used to sort of underpin those in that early stages of Plan Change 1 for Wakaka Regional Council, and then later used by 4NZ in both the council hearing stage and our evidence here. And so when I say that they're correct, I mean that the information that Stu, Mr. Easton's used has been checked by NIWA and is the same as what they produced for Plan Change 1.
Thank you. And one other supplementary topic is you would have heard one of the commissioners asking about this 30%, 50% plus reduction in that other plan change. Is that something you know anything about?
Yes. So I know about plan change too, and also modelling that's been undertaken in the Waikato related to the reductions that might be expected with the implementation of good management practices for vegetable. the care change too, there was two different types of overseer modelling undertaken to estimate the effectiveness of good management practices. So there was some modelling undertaken by Dan Bloomer that the horticulture sector was involved with and represented the crop rotations in a very detailed manner. And in that modelling, we also predicted, or we tried to represent with an overseer the mitigations that we knew could be implemented based on freshwater farmlands or farmlands. And so for vegetable production, in terms of what could be represented in overseer, the main things were a reduction in nitrogen associated with better matching crop demand with nutrient supply, and in particular the alignment of fertiliser use with the more recent crop manure, which is breeding water, it's a few years old now. And that was one of the main mitigations that was implemented, and another one was related to buffer strips. And so that modelling predicted a reduction in vegetable production in Livin of between 7% and 45%, and that depended on the rotation, just and the average in terms of that catchment from that detailed modelling that was undertaken by council and the sector was about 30%. Dr. Anne-Marie Jolly, she undertook some different modelling for the council, and she had a different approach to her representation of vegetables within the overseer. So instead of modelling the sort of full rotation, which would be our preference, that is to say all of the crops that you might grow in a sequence, so including, you know, say barley or you know, a fallow period, because we think it's really important to think about that long-term sequence of crops, because the crops themselves, they take up some of the nitrogen from the residue from the previous crop. Anyway, her modelling didn't look at it that way. She looked at a smaller sequence of crops, say like just a couple of crops in sequence. And so, and Mr. Ford can speak to this, but he had some concerns about it. Essentially, she was still modelling the same good management practices, and there was quite a good level of agreement about which practices should be implemented between her and Mr. Barber, who's also presenting evidence here. But it was just the way that she modelled an overseer achieved greater percentage production than we, what our experts are perhaps realistic. So I suppose no question about what would actually be done on farm. The question is to what percentage of production that might achieve. Now, when it comes to Waikato, we have recently commissioned some modelling, and this has been with Auckland Council. It's a peer and ag report, which is referenced in Stuart Ford's evidence. And that is relevant to Waikato because it's the same rotation. And it's very detailed modelling, and it's been undertaken in Axum. In that modelling, there's a lot of work done with growers looking at the kinds of mitigations that they could apply, both in clues similar to what I described earlier about matching nitrogen with crop demand, but also about improvement of irrigation practices. What that modelling has shown or indicated is that there's not much to be gained on the fertiliser optimisation space within Pukekohe, partly because of the growers already having adopted, being quite far along the journey in terms of adopting good management practice, and I suppose there's a point there about the point at which that assessment is done, you know, where the percentage of time comes from, because in Land Change 2 we were sort of looking back to the notified stage with some of that modelling, so
2012.
Yeah, some years in the past. However, with the irrigation modelling that was undertaken in the Axum modelling, there was quite a high percentage of production that was predicted, in the order of 20% or more. So, in the Waikato, we might predict that there could be reductions associated in the order of 20% with growers implementing best practices in terms of really matching plant demand with nutrient supply, and Andrew Barber can speak to the methods associated with that, and also adopting the best irrigation practices. But I guess so it's in that sort of order, although, you know, it does kind of depend on the moment in time that you're assessing against, or the, how well, because in my evidence you'll see that we've got a really good high adoption rate of industry practices within these catches. The growers are really sort of on the journey.
It may be a long answer, but it was a very good answer. Thank you. I'm largely answered my question. But in terms of the start date, worked from 2016, which I understand is the date of the perfected year, would you be able to give some indication of the likely reduction that's possible from then to some point in the future?
Yes. Well, and Stuart might be able to speak to this more accurately than me, because he undertook, there was a previous modelling, which was the 2014 Stuart Ford modelling, that was actually the election, right, it was done over there, it was done at the Kukui rotations, and it was done with quite a lot of regional council on that occasion. And it is the election that is kind of the election rate that is used in those legal models for the catch modelling. Now, that modelling, at the time, he predicted, I believe, that the reductions, that sort of below, once you get to good management practice, going beyond that starts to crop yield. But what he says in his evidence, and I can't remember which paragraph, he says that compared to the surveys that were done in 2014 and compared to the Peer and Ag surveys that were done sort of 10 years later, in 2023, there has been quite a significant reduction in the amount of fertilizer that growers are applying. So I'm not sure if he could give you an exact percentage, but I think what we could say is that, you know, that order, 20%, probably isn't unreasonable when you're looking back to that sort of notification date, because we've been making these sorts of improvements. And you know, like, some growers still have more work to do, so there will be improvements that are associated with this plan change as well.
So is that 20% looking back and 20% possibly coming forward?
I think that's probably more if you took the data to that. I mean, possibly after you've thought about this, but I would say I would probably be more confident if you were to say 2016 rather than to suggest that there was another, you know, that...
It's 1 o'clock.
Yes, Colonel, we'll be taking the break as soon as you've completed any other introductory matters you want to do.
Thank you. It was really just I was going to ask about the gap in the EMS, but
we can come back and you can do that after lunch.
Okay. Yes.
Now, Ms. Hand, you're not under cross examination at this stage, so there's no restriction in terms of your discussions with her about anything you want to elaborate on.
Yeah. I'll see if we can get you a copy of the least two of the major ones, the gap and the EMS.
Yes, if there are electronic copies
that might be all around,
if they're sent to the registrar, she can distribute them electronically.
I don't think I'll be able to do hard copies, but the electronic
fine.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, it's not really, it's in our bottles as well.